Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I am Paul Starobin, and welcome to America and Beyond on the New Books Network. My guest today is Wayne E. Lee, the Bruce W. Kearney Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He specializes in early modern military history, with a particular focus on North America and the Atlantic world, but also teaches military history from a full global perspective at the undergraduate and graduate level, and teaches courses on violence, as well as on the early English exploration of the Atlantic. As a kind of an additional career, he works with archaeology projects in the Balkans and has numerous publications in that field. His publications include the subject of today's discussion, The Cutting Off Way, Indigenous Warfare in Eastern North America, 1500 to 1800, which was published this year by the University of North Carolina Press. Welcome to America and Beyond, Wayne Lee.
Thanks, Paul. It's good to be here.
Well, I found your book fascinating, and I think the title in the first place is something that we might explore. What do you mean by the cutting off way of indigenous warfare?
Yeah, sure. There's two sort of points to this. One is to try to replace an older term, which I talk about in the book a little bit, that I find both inaccurate and sort of denigrating to Native American practice. And that is, the old term is the skulking way of war, which was a term that was used by colonists fairly often with respect to what Indians were up to. You know, that, you know, they would often literally say, you know, those Indians and their skulking way. And the implication of that, the use of that term in the 17th and 18th century, was that the Indians were cowardly, that they were sneaky, that their warfare depended on ambush only, that they would not fight in the open. And so it's absolutely true. The historian who used that term is accurate in the sense that that was how the colonists called it. But one of the objectives of the book was to try to flip the perspective, to see warfare from a Native perspective and not from a colonial perspective. What were they trying to do? What were they trying to accomplish? And what were they trying to protect? And that's what the cutting off way refers to. In one sense, it's about a tactic, a technique that is designed to protect your population from excessive casualties. And so you deliberately target a part of your enemy. And the part can vary in scale from a small party that is out gathering wood or water or hunting, or it can go up the scale to trying to cut off a whole village. And Native nations tended to live in clusters of villages. And it's only late in the colonial period, when population reduction is really taken hold, that we reimagine a Native nation as being in a single village. And therefore, one of the things I say in the book, in fact, is that that's one of the things, that decline in population is one of the things that makes them strategically vulnerable. Because having a cluster of related villages that would come to each other's aid when attacked, when one of them is attacked, is what gave a nation strategic depth on defense. And it's also what limits the time that an attacker has. And so if they're trying to cut off or attack a single village, they know they only have so much time before local reinforcements arrive to help defend that village.
Right.
So all of their tactics are predicated on that assumption.
Right. Was any one of the Native American nations a innovator or in some way creator of this technique? I mean, do we know how it evolved?
Oh, no. In many ways, it corresponds to what we know about non-state warfare around the world for much of history, it bears many similarities to what we find in the ethnographic and archaeological and historical record from other places. One of the things that we actually get from this particular environment, that is to say, Eastern North America at the time of contact, is we get fairly voluminous written records, which is what we don't have for other places.
Right. Well, what other places, for example, would you draw parallels to?
Well, what we know about hunter-gatherer warfare in, say, Africa or Australia, the Aboriginal peoples, we see some similar patterns. And how we see early agricultural pastoral warfare in the sort of Mediterranean basin area, that is warfare between pastoral peoples and agricultural peoples, you tend to see pastoral peoples follow a similar pattern of attack and retreat. That's what the cutting off way is really a reference to, is the attack and retreat. And I use the term cutting off not because it bears any particular linguistic similarity to what natives are saying, because we don't necessarily have the words to describe how they would describe it at the time. But it is a term that the English use in translations of Indian commentary. They'll say that the Indians wanted to cut them off. In the English phrase at the time, really all it means is kill. You cut someone off, you kill them. It's equivalent to a still modern phrase used in England, that is to knock them on the head.
Right.
Which is referring to kill them. We don't use it in America, but it's a phrase in England. And it's sort of similar. If you cut them off, you're talking about killing.
How did you... your interest in this, I'm curious, how did it evolve? Is this something that, was there a childhood interest? Was it something that came later? I mean, it's a very particular type of interest and especially, I imagine, and I know that, you know, as I said in the introduction, that you have this kind of additional career working with archaeology projects. So it seems like there's something here that's kind of connecting, and that perhaps tells us something about yourself in terms of your interests.
Well, I started out writing my dissertation on warfare and violence in colonial period North Carolina, and that's in part because of where I was in grad school, which was at Duke. And one of the problems that I had was I needed to figure out how to be able to do archival research relatively cheaply because of funding issues and all of that sort of life issue. And so I chose North Carolina because many of the archives were available locally, not all of them, many of them. And so, but I was writing about white people. I was writing about the colonists and later the revolutionaries, because I was writing about the 18th century and the Revolutionary War. And I reached the conclusion during writing that I needed to know more about how Native American warfare worked. What does it look like? What were they trying to do? Because I was thinking at the time about how did that then change the way colonists thought about it? Did the experience of contact change colonial thinking about it? And I thought it probably had, but the evidence is actually harder to tease out than you might think. And so I spent some time, my first project after that first book was actually about Native American. And pieces of that appear in this book, pieces of that early attempt to figure that out. But meanwhile, along the way, if you're suggesting or hinting at it, I in parallel, originally completely separate from my historical career, I was involved in archaeology projects in Greece and then later in Albania, some shorter projects in Croatia and Hungary. And what that did was expose me to anthropological theories of war, sometimes in conversations. And projects that I was on were not necessarily related to warfare, but warfare comes up even when you don't want it to. And it also helped me learn how to read archaeologists' work. Because if you're not just accustomed to it, to teasing out the arguments, then you know it's something you have to learn how to do. And so eventually these two threads started coming together in your 20s. That thinking about warfare through an anthropological lens, being able to use archaeological evidence for historical purposes. And so in the end, a lot of this book, in fact, pulls from the anthropological literature and it uses archaeological evidence, although grounded and rooted in historical
perspective. Yeah. And that was one of my questions as I read the book or thoughts is just how do we know what we know, particularly in the pre-contact stage? I mean, it's clear enough. You quote from European accounts and settlers, you know, who are direct observers or at least getting secondhand information. But how do we really know what we know about, you know, going back essentially well before the contact period?
Yeah, well, that is a tricky. Well, okay, to be clear, you'll note the date stamps on the book, which is 1500 to 1800. I'm not making a lot of claims about the pre-contact period. I make some claims that there is highly likely that the continuity between the pre-contact period and at least the early contact period and how Native Americans think about war is there. Because they've been fighting each other for centuries. And when, as a world military historian, one of the things that I'm working on, in fact, this book fits into a larger project about the nature of war around the world, nature of conquest, is that your norm of war is set by the people you normally fight. That is, say, you exist in a cockpit of competition and you arrive at a set of understandings about what war does, how it works, what kinds of behaviors you do, what kinds of behaviors work and or are acceptable. And then you might suddenly encounter somebody else who's got a whole different set of norms, got a different set of technologies, got a different set of expectations, and then you have a clash of expectations. And that's part of my argument is we should just take that as a given, that there is that the Native Americans were existing prior to contact in a cockpit of competition, and violent competition.
Well, yes. I mean, at one point in the book, you describe the warfare as, quote unquote, endemic.
I do.
And that was another question I had just about the incidents of warfare within these Native American communities between the nations or the tribes. And I think probably a lot of people have that question because we're so used to, you know, through popular culture, we're just used to experiencing the warfare between the Europeans, the settlers, and, you know, the Native Americans. I mean, that's seems like what we're getting. We don't get as much of this, you know, warfare between the Native American nations, and yet, I mean, endemic is a powerful word.
Yeah, it is, and it's intended to be, but it also has limits. We think we use it. We were borrowing that word from disease studies, right?
Yes,
it's endemic in the sense that it's present, but it's not devastating.
Embedded, even
it's embedded, but it doesn't necessarily overthrow the very fundamentals of your society on any sort of regular basis.
Not necessarily, but you know.
It can. Yeah, no, absolutely. It can. It just depends on the circumstance. And so, just to give a quick example, you know, with the normal narratives of warfare after contact between Europeans and Indians have bounded war dates. You know, there's the first Anglo-Powhatan, there's the first Tuscarora, there's the Yamasee War, and all of those are sort of bounded and reported to us in our original texts and in our textbooks with start and end dates. And if you ever look at them, most of them are relatively short start and end dates. You know, a war will last 2 or 3 years. King Philip's War is 2 years. Pequot War is a year and a half. The Yamasee War is a couple of years. But the Cherokees and the Creeks went to war with each other between 1715 and 1752. Continuous, endemic.
Why?
Well, they were competing over a variety of issues, including access to European trade. And during one of the negotiations for over those issues, in fact, issues related to the Yamasee War, so one war sometimes spins into the next one, the Cherokees were divided into multiple different political factions. And one faction really wanted the war with the Creeks to start. And so they actually killed a Creek delegation in Cherokee country that was on a diplomatic mission in 1715. And we know about that in part coincidentally because there was a South Carolinian delegation in Cherokee country at the time it happened. And so we have a narrative account of that killing and the immediate Cherokee response and then the Creek response, which was the start of war, because that violated Native notions of proper diplomatic procedure. And it also created blood debt requirements because all of the people who were killed in that delegation were important persons in Creek society with connections to multiple towns in Creek Nation. And so all of those towns and all of their relatives activated essentially the blood revenge requirement. They all needed to take revenge. So they would launch their attacks on Cherokee country and the Cherokees would launch their attacks on the Creek country. But you don't see anyone sort of putting together a giant army in the European sense and marching to the frontier and crossing the front. That's not the way war worked. It was much more of an ongoing episodic, although endemic.
Right. I see what you're saying. It's endemic. And now you talked about the blood revenge, which is a subject of a chapter. And I think it's important to establish blood revenge as a kind of root cause or function of war.
Well, it is a root cause and function, but it's also something that we can be overly distracted. And this is one of the things that I was trying to write partially against, although without denying. So think about it this way. All society, states, Native nations, whatever, when they go to war at two different levels of motivation. There's a motivation for the collective to go to war. Why is the nation, why is the state going to war? What is it hoping to achieve? And then the other level is the individual who goes to war on the state's behalf. Why are they going? Now, in the modern state, we can talk about conscription and say the individual didn't have any choice, although that would be an interesting debate that we tend to separate issue. But at almost any other form of society, democracy or a nation that relies on relatively egalitarian and consensual-based forms of decision-making and government, like a Native nation, you can't just go around and say, all right, hey, you six guys, come with me. We're going on a raid. You've got to persuade them. And the motivations for individuals in a Native nation very often includes the blood revenge requirement, that there is a reason why they are because they killed some of us, and we need to kill some of them back. And some of the people they killed were my relatives, and so I feel obligated to go and take revenge. And so the collective nation may have goals beyond
it. They may right, just have revenge. But it might start with the revenge. And is the initial killing, by definition, an intentional one, a murder, or could have happened in any circumstances? I mean, how did the... let's say the original killing tend to happen in the first place? Was it just a deliberate act of what we think of as murder?
Well, or it can be a death that is attributed to the enemy, because there are spiritual powers at work in the world, very often manifested in disease. If we believe that that killing was generated by another side without necessarily knowing who exactly did it, they can still therefore become the subject of the blood revenge requirement.
Wow. So even and, though it may have, I mean, do you think that happened frequently where there was kind of just misattributed or just these kind of vague circumstances?
Well, I don't think we have any way. Our sources don't give us any way to see how often this would have happened, but we do see it happen. There are occasions where it's absolutely taking place. And we also know that these blood revenge requirements can cycle on and on and on for more than a generation without anybody even remembering necessarily what the first killing was.
Yes, well,
The raids between the Iroquois, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and the Catawba, for example, go on for decades, all based on some original blood revenge requirement. And they're all relatively small raids because they're 600 miles apart. And so that over land.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the wars between the Catawba and the Haudenosaunee are one of the conflicts that originally inspired me to look even deeper into this, because it was a massive logistical undertaking to be going 600 miles over land as opposed to being able to paddle down river or take a boat.
Right. So that was one of the original interesting. Let me. So blood revenge may be a kind of initial cause or path to war, but as you note in the book, it can expand quite beyond that, right, into other reasons for warfare.
Well, no, it's not that I see it expanding into other reasons. They coexist.
Okay.
That you can, the nation can have a hope for gaining control over another nation and demanding tribute from them. Or, as I discussed in the final chapter of the book, and one of the most original contributions of the book, the nation can hope for more expansive hunting territory by forcing another nation to move, to displace
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a national level objective.
Yes.
But to accomplish that, you've got to have individuals willing to go along.
You've got to sort of start with that basis. And you, which you come back to in the concluding chapter, as well as in the chapter on blood revenge. And you write that the cultural mandate for revenge proved extremely difficult to overcome. And I found myself wondering, you know, as I read that, is this a universal principle? I somewhat tend to resist the modern parallels, but nevertheless, is it fair to go to, for example, Israel-Gaza right now? I mean, the Prime Minister of Israel, after these horrific October 7th attacks, massacres, really, by Hamas, vowed to exact a mighty revenge. And so that seemed to strike a resonant chord.
Yes, I would never want to say that revenge only functions as an individual motive. It is absolutely present at the national level. And in some ways, the modern creation of the nation state, and in its, especially in some ways, in its more democratic forms, enables the desire for revenge to overcome political calculation.
Well, why especially the democratic? That's intriguing.
Well, because if you think about, for example, the classic era sort of state-on-state warfare, which is the 17th, 18th, 19th century, where, and if you remember it from your history textbooks, the list of wars in Europe in the 18th century in particular, you have the War of Austrian Succession, the War of Spanish Succession, the War of English Succession. And a lot of these wars, we sometimes call them cabinet wars. They were wars fought by kings ruling countries over the control of slices of territory, or over the control of who would be the king next in some other country or in their own country. And so they were highly confined in some ways in terms of motive. There was no sense of revenge. There was no sense of popular cry for the destruction of a hated enemy. Although some of that starts to build. In fact, there's an argument that the repeated wars between France and England within this period creates a kind of Englishness, creates a kind of notion of English nation that is sort of aligned against its traditional enemies. That's the nation, that notion of a people, of
yes,
an ethnicity.
Right.
That then acquires over time, it can acquire over time, that we must take revenge on those who have affronted us. And in the modern era, the creation of the nation state, one of the things that it does, the creation of the modern nation state in the 19th century, is it opens up that can of worms that we, the Germans, must be strong and we must either defeat and or take revenge on the French. And then later, of course, when the French are defeated in 1871, it's the French nation that's demanding revenge, that
yes,
they want a national level.
Yes.
And I think some of that persists into the modern world at
yes,
the national level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Balkans, too, you mentioned that you would, you know, the specialty in the Balkans, which we think of almost as a catchword or metaphor for these kinds of wars, which could be pretty vicious as well. I mean, we saw in the collapse of the former Yugoslavia, the, you know, atrocities in the Balkans and Serbians and Bosnia and so forth. So none of that has certainly been extinguished from the human condition.
No, that's right. And I think it's also important to recognize the interactions between, as I was suggesting, the Native Nations, there's an interaction between the state level motivations and the strength of the state and individual motivations. So the individuals in the Balkans who are experiencing atrocity, or individuals in Gaza who are experiencing atrocity, will carry that desire for revenge with them as individuals. The question will be, what will the state do in response? Will it seek to control those individual desires for revenge in order to limit the violence the state gets dragged into? Or will the state feel pushed by those individual desires for revenge to engage in further violence?
Yes.
To wage their population?
Yeah. And that's
and
a theme.
Go either way.
Yeah. And it's a theme in the book because you write, there's sort of interesting parallels or tensions between the indigenous way of war and, let's say, the European way of war, even if they're... So on these parallels, you write that there was a limited notion of revenge that differed dramatically from the European ideology of revenge in war, which you characterize as a no-holds-barred retaliation. So even if we accept this principle of revenge, it doesn't necessarily work out in the same way.
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the things that I don't want people to hear me saying that Native Americans were sort of afflicted or infected with the notion of revenge that Europeans didn't have. In some ways, it's quite the reverse,
mm-hmm,
in that Native notions of revenge were relatively easily satisfied. An individual who felt that need for revenge could kill or take prisoner one other person and feel that they had accomplished what needed to be done. And what we see when European colonists are attacked is that they have a more expansive notion of the requirements of revenge, the desire to go out and destroy an entire nation of Indians rather than be satisfied by this tit-for-tat requirement. And the tit for tat might go on for a long time in an endemic way, but it's very small scale. Whereas the European nations have the state capacity to mobilize its whole population to go take revenge in a very wholesale manner and hope or assume that they can do it quickly and end it.
Yeah. And there is this notion that, I acquired in the graduate studies of international relations of deterrence, which perhaps wrongly I have tended to think of in sort of universal fashions, but it was certainly in the modern way of thinking about warfare, and particularly in the nuclear age, notions of deterrence have enormous weight. I mean, scholars, diplomats like Henry Kissinger would talk endlessly about what was needed to establish or reestablish deterrence. And it doesn't appear that this was the way that the Native Americans thought so much, and this notion of more limited warfare, tit for tat. It wasn't that they felt like they needed to do whatever needed to be done so that would never be another attack.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
There's a term that I use in the book that I think should become, honestly think should become more current in thinking about this period and these people, which is reputation management. That taking revenge is not purely emotion. Emotion is very much involved. There's been a recent book that talks about this. Matt Kruger's work on the Susquehanna talks about the role of emotion in their violence and in other things. But it's also important to recognize that failure to take revenge diminishes your reputation in the eyes of your enemies and suggests weakness and vulnerability. And so that if you're not taking revenge, you're not creating a reputation that functions in a deterrence mode. And again, none of these are perfect deterrents. None of these are perfect. And particularities of the situation always matter. The personalities of individuals involved always matter. One of the ways we can see the particularities and the idiosyncrasies of personality is in the faction within an image. When we have good enough records, when there were enough traders and enough European diplomats sort of constantly in Indian country, and the Cherokees are a good example of this, we can start to see how the divisions within the Cherokee Nation, which, and they were already divided into three or four regions, depending on how you divide them up. Some of them wanted to work with the French. Some of them wanted to work with the English. And they could hold very hard to that desire. I want to work with the English. I don't want to work with the French. And you know, there's, in some ways, it's about their own internal dynamics. One guy is using English to say, I want to become more powerful amongst the Cherokees with English help, whereas another guy said, I want to become more powerful than Cherokees with French help. And that there's this, so that you've got how much trade value can the French provide, how much trade value can the English provide, what's the dynamic between these two different Cherokee leaders, why do they dislike each other, why are they fighting for more power over their own people?
Right.
So there's all sorts
Yes, it's a mistake to think that there's some kind of uniformity among the Indian or Native American nations and the way they approached warfare. Although you do, again, point to some interesting contrast. I was sort of fascinated by your treatment of prisoners and how differently, you know, in the European model and way, prisoner exchanges were basically seen as routine and desirous. But as you write, for entirely different reasons, they were thought about in another way, typically by the Native American makers of war, right?
Yes, the taking of prisoners and the treatment of prisoners, function of prisoners, is clearly one of the most conflict-causing of cultural differences between Europeans and Native Americans. And it's a deeply embedded cultural expectation. And remember, when I say deeply embedded, this goes back to what we were talking about before, that Native Americans have been fighting each other for hundreds of years. And in that process, they had evolved an attitude towards prisoners. The primary function is several layers. So first layer is taking a prisoner is the greatest evidence for my success as a warrior. If I take a prisoner, then I have been massively successful. So I get individual social status for taking a prisoner. And then I can take that prisoner.
Any prisoner? Would it matter whether it was a woman, a child, an elderly person, or an actual warrior?
Any prisoner.
Okay.
And I can then take that prisoner back to my home village. And one of several things can happen. I can... and often it's determined by the women. Now, this varies somewhat from nation to nation within North America, so it's not a completely uniform pattern. But for the most part, the women of the home village, hometown, will decide the fate of the prisoner. One fate is to be, especially for adult men, is to be tortured to death by the community to death, which is a way of expunging grief over your own loss as part of the revenge cycle. And, you know, that looked at from a very high altitude, there is an advantage to that because the entire community is expunging the desire for revenge by doing this, that this act of tremendous violence against a single person's body can prevent further violence because this need for revenge is diminished by having accomplished it. And at the same time, presumably this raiding party has come back with more than one prisoner. You know, one prisoner will be tortured to death, maybe a couple, but the others will be adopted into society as replacement kin for your own losses. And now again, this will vary from place to place from where you are as to how exactly this works. But it's also an embedded expectation. People who are taken prisoner more or less know this is what's likely to happen. And because, to go back to our Catawba Haudenosaunee, we're 600 miles apart, the odds of me sort of escaping and then getting all the way back home are very low. And so it's going to behoove me to just try to blend in with what's happening. This is how I'm going to eat. This is how I'm going to have shelter and clothing, is by becoming the niece or the nephew of these people who've taken me prison. And so it's an embedded assumption that this is a functional way of adopting kin in your society, and they will be real kin in your society. Now, obviously, this works better with children. They're going to adapt into that system more easily because they're more flexible. And it's very often done with women, but it's also done with adult men. Some of our most famous sort of frontier characters in American lore are adult white men who were adopted into Native societies and lived amongst and with those Native societies sometimes for years.
Like what? Which people?
Daniel Boone is an adopted Shawnee. Mm-hmm. And he retained his Indian name and his Indian kin, even as he went back into white society. And then living on the frontier, he would move back and forth across the frontier and still have that identity. But we have lots of other adult men who were taken captive. And some of them would reject their Indian identity when they got back to white society. Some of them would write about it. But some of them would retain it as a tool of advantage. William Johnson, the Indian superintendent for the British Empire in the North, famously was an adopted Mohawk. And it was a very important diplomatic tool for him to retain that Indian name. And his adoption was somewhat less war-related and more sort of, I'm going to say, customary as opposed to prisoner-based.
Right.
The idea of adoption was real. Mm-hmm. And in very many of the nations, the kinship went through the mother. And so if an adopted male then had married someone that had children, and the children took their clan membership through the mother, they were matrilineal. And so there was no sense of half-blood, this really derogatory term that white people use.
Right.
For the Native people, you're an Indian.
Right. No matter, I mean, when you say torture as well, does that encompass rape as a practice of women or young women, girls?
No, quite famously, Native nations east of the Mississippi, I haven't looked closely at the records west of the Mississippi, but certainly east of Mississippi, the evidence for rape by Native nations is almost zero. In fact, I would say it's zero. Any attempt to find it is pretty highly interpreted.
Wow. And we associate that in our popular mind. I think rape is almost universally associated as very likely to occur in an atmosphere of war and in the chaotic conditions of war, almost as a legitimate prize of war in the eyes of the soldiers who've been, you know, were at threat of risk of losing their lives anyway.
That's right. European soldiers almost assume it as a perquisite of war at that time, and obviously at other times as well, some of them quite notorious. But in Native societies, it's sex of any kind, while on campaign, was typically prohibited as undermining this the the power of the spirit world to sustain you while you're on campaign. We want to walk almost all the way back to basic spiritual beliefs, in which Native Americans believe that the spirit world was constantly interacting with and affecting the material in a way much more sort of persistent and immanent than even Christians would have had who believed in a providential God. You know, God would intervene. That there was spirits all around, constantly interacting, and that certain people had more access to the spirit world than others, but you had to be constantly wary of what was happening in the spirit world because it would affect you in the medium, in the material world. And one of the things was sexual purity, preparing for and going on campaign. And that's one of the reasons you don't see evidence for rape.
Right. I mean, and you're right with respect to the spiritual world that after a war, there was typically what you call a ritual of purification that may include fasting or so forth, which, yeah, talk more about that. I mean, that's not something we would necessarily think of.
Right. We see it described. Again, our descriptions are from European witnesses, and they almost all the nations that you can get any sort of description of what a post-campaign homecoming looks like, all of them seem to include multiple days of isolation to undergo a purification. And we don't know, quote-unquote, why. We can make assumptions that the notion is that killing is creating harm for the killer, and that for the killer. But that's an assumption. We don't really know. But it fits the ethnographic record we have from other societies and our own experiences with what we now talk about as PTSD and the need for returning soldiers to not purify themselves, but to reckon with their experiences in one way or another, whether that's by writing or talking with each other or seeing a counselor or whatever, that there is some need to reestablish moral and spiritual balance.
I mean, were there concepts of personal guilt?
Again, our records aren't going to let us that deep. I've never seen anything that would get us that deep inside the mentality of Native American. I mean, we in that period, and so it's hard for us to say, but it surely looks, I mean, it surely seems to be, there's again, deeply embedded expectation that when you come home, this is what you do. You spend 2 days in a sweat lodge, or it varies, again, depending on which nation you're in, the process varies, the practice varies.
Yeah. But
there is a sense of a need for purification.
Mm-hmm. And just as you write also that there was typically quite a bit of deliberation before a war campaign. And I can imagine, you know, as you say, there are a number of reasons for that, and you have to, you know, make sure you've raised enough people and so forth. But the deliberation aspect is interesting. I mean, does that reflect at least in part this sense that you're about to do a very, very serious thing that could involve a lot of consequences so far as the spiritual world is concerned?
No. Possibly, but it seems more, the front end of the campaign is much more to me, more like a mobilization recruitment effort than a purification issue. It's more like getting people whipped up. This is what we're seeking. This is what's happened, been done to us, that we need to deal with. It's more of a political calculation. What are the risks? We should never assume they don't calculate the risks before doing something. You know, what's the risk reward calculus? And we see that pretty clearly, especially when European diplomats come into a Native nation and want their help as allies. And the Natives are like, all right, well, you're going to have to, you know, pay us this much. You're going to have to supply us from this point forward. We want you to build a fort here in our villages because that would be useful to us. And you can very much see the political calculus that's taking place at the outset of campaign.
Yeah. Well, another aspect of the deliberation, at least, that had me thinking was that it was in some ways not necessarily so hierarchical in the way that these decisions were approached. I mean, I hesitate to use the term small d democracy, but it kind of felt that way. I mean, how much of a say did just the kind of, you know, let's say regular conscript have over what was about to be happening? Or was there a lot of deference to the, you know, the leader, the war leader of the, you know, the party that was contemplating the action?
Yeah, it's a highly consensus-based decision-making system. You're very rarely going to get a single personality saying, all right, go. It's much more going to be a council. In many of these societies, there's also going to be the women's council is going to be involved in the decision-making. Very often it's the women decide for peace or war, not just the men. There are exceptions. And in fact, some of the exceptions are really important in America. Because one of the biggest exceptions is Powhatan, in the Powhatan chiefdom, where Jamestown first sets up, where he appears to have achieved in the years prior to the immediate years prior to the founding of Jamestown in 1607, to have achieved a level of authority over a fairly wide landscape, the Potomac Basin area, that was almost kingly. We call him, anthropologists have a specific term for his level of authority. They call him a paramount chief.
Paramount chief.
That he was a chief of chiefs.
Chief of chiefs. That's good.
And that we see him ordering villages to do certain things, subordinate villages to do certain things. We see him commanding armies in ways that seem much more hierarchical and
autocratic kind of style.
But as we move into the inland and over time into the colonial period, almost all of the other societies that we as historians encounter are much more consensus-based and at least semi-egalitarian.
Right. And that's interesting. And the other aspect of it that, you know, again, sort of a parallel, we almost assume that a lot of the European wars are fought for larger aims, however they began, whether it's territorial in nature, it's, you know, empires creating buffer states and populations, exacting tribute, all these kinds of things. And I sense from the book that although you were acknowledging that there were and could be these kind of wider aims, you are also acknowledging that there's quite a bit of debate about that among the specialists in this area, right? About the sort of larger or more sort of political aspects of warfare.
Well, most of our sources are about wars between Indians and colonists, whether French, Spanish, English. And those are mostly wars of self-defense. And the political aim of self-defense is clear, right? Part of the objective of the book was to say, okay, but what about all the wars that we know were happening between the Indians before contact and after contact? What were those about? And almost far too often, the assumption has been, oh, they weren't about anything material. They were about small-scale revenge issues. They were, you know, there's no giant political cause. Actually, part of what I was trying to say was, no, that's not the case. There were political objectives, what we think of as political objectives. You know, reputation management is a political objective. A demanding tribute from a newly subordinated village is a political objective.
Yeah, and tribute, let's just say, could consist of what? What was tribute?
Well, that very often was either, well, I should say there's two kinds, basically. There's low bulk, high value exotic goods that you took more or less as a symbol of their submission.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is high bulk subsistence. Where, in fact, we talked about Powhatan just a second ago. This is one of the things that makes Powhatan stand out, is that we see canoe loads, and these are big canoe loads of corn and other foods being delivered to Powhatan for storage and often for redistribution, because he'll cement his own hierarchical power by redistributing goods. And so That's possible in Chesapeake because you can move bulk goods by water. Virtually all the villages are essentially on the water. When you talk about inland overland relations, you know, we tend to see tribute as more low bulk, high value exotic goods. And the other good that you want, not necessarily in tribute, is more hunting territory. There's almost no need at these population levels for more agricultural territory, which is what a European would normally think of as territorial conquest, is we're going to conquer farmland. For the Native Americans, the bigger acreage requirements is gathering areas where you have, you know, reliable places where you can go get aquatic proteins, shellfish, oysters, and or fish runs, and hunting, especially for deer. And so one of the things that I was able to show, and again, I think fairly uniquely in this book, is the extent to which some native wars are being fought to displace their enemies, to increase the size of the buffer zone between them, or to move the buffer zone between them so that you have more safe and reliable hunting spaces on your end of that buffer and taking it away from their end. And again, the Creeks and the Cherokees, because they're so well documented over such a long period of time, we can see this happening where the Creeks seem to be forcing the Cherokees to retreat to the north. And that later in the 1770s, we actually see the Creeks make a claim in English courts about their conquest of that territory by war. They won it with the sword, to use the English expression. And that therefore it's theirs. Cherokees can't sell it to the colonial governments.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just quite intricate. And I think that's part of the fascination of this book. And we're going to wrap it up. I mean, I'm going to encourage everyone to read this book. I think it will overturn a lot of our sort of rote expectations about Native Americans and their way of warfare, and should cause people to reflect more on that. I want to thank you, Wayne Lee, for being here. And this is Paul Starobin for America and Beyond on the New Books Network.